every single one of us has woken up today with less rights than we had yesterday. It's important to tell the truth of what's going on. I think it's important for us to also tackle this myth that this is somehow about babies or children. Who are we protecting? Who does this protect? No one. Overturning Roe puts every single one of us in danger. But we are here to solve this issue. Our job is to develop a path forward.
I remember the day when it was exposed SCOTUS was planning to overturn the long-standing court precedent, Roe versus Wade. I was sitting at my sister's dining table. My eyes had been screwed to my phone screen, and my thumb was sore from scrolling endlessly down a Twitter and Instagram pit of doom. I kept refreshing my email and texting every politically aligned friend I had. It's fucking barbaric. I typed over and over. I took screenshots of every headline I saw. But it was useless. This would happen. SCOTUS would overturn Roe v. Wade. And any progress women had made to grasp ownership over their bodies was lost. I thought a lot about my body. I thought about the freedom I had felt in my body at various times in my life. I suddenly felt very grateful for my body, for its abilities. And I felt deeply, deeply protective of every corner of myself. So I guess I should introduce myself. My name is Grace. I've been lucky enough to intern with the organization Power in Place for this summer, 2023. This organization is incredible, and we do work to highlight women and non-binary individuals in government who are doing incredible work and breaking the glass ceiling, if you will. This podcast is a part of the Summers with Pip collection, and I encourage you to listen to all of the other podcasts that are listed under our page. Since Roe v. Wade was overturned over a year ago now, there's been a lot of conversation around what our future looks like. And it can be a really scary conversation. It's hard to feel empowered right now, I think. My only hope with this podcast episode is to highlight women who have been doing tremendous work in this fight for reproductive freedom. So if you want to join me for the next little less than an hour to hear some of my own thoughts and opinions, hear me chat with a friend, and learn about some badass women in our history, then please continue listening. Access to contraception was an early key liberator for women in this country, and Emma Goldman fought tirelessly to provide the women of her time with information and access to contraception, which in turn provided them with some more social and economic freedom. Goldman believed that sexual freedom coincided directly with social and economic freedom. Emma Goldman, who was a political activist in many ways, an anarchist, a writer. She was critical for the fight for reproductive rights, and she campaigned for the legalization of birth control in the early 1900s. She was arrested twice and imprisoned once for distributing informative materials and giving lectures in support of birth control and about women's options around birth control. She once said, "While I'm not particularly anxious to go to jail, I should yet be glad to do so. If thereby I can add my mite to the importance of birth control and the wiping off our antiquated law upon the statue." Elaine Brown, who is an American activist who was born in 1943, she's currently 80 years old today, and she still fights for reproductive freedom and women's freedom. In the 1970s, she was the first woman chair of the Black Panther Party, After Roe v. Wade was passed, she said, "I would support every assertion of human rights by women, from the right to abortion to the right of equality with men as laborers and leaders." It was still unclear at the time that Brown said this how the Supreme Court's decision would affect Black women. She did a lot to shift the Black Panthers Party's perspective on women's rights and healthcare access. She was a huge supporter of holistic healthcare practices and said that Black women need more than a Supreme Court decision to guarantee them safe and accessible abortion care. The party was not always in agreement in their attitudes towards women. One of the Black Panther Party's main principles was the right to self-determination. So Brown used that belief and guideline to structure a lot of her activism for women's reproductive rights. She's still an activist today and has lectured at over 40 colleges and universities. Who you heard speaking at the beginning of this podcast was United States Representative AOC. Along with AOC, there are numerous incredible women in politics who are fighting for reproductive justice every day. Here are just two examples. Jo Comerford, who is a Massachusetts state senator and the first woman to hold the Franklin, Worcester, and Hampshire County Senate seat, and the first official in this seat to be elected as a write-in candidate. So she's accomplished a lot, and I've had the pleasure of meeting her recently and interviewing her. She spent a year running a women's shelter when she was in her 20s and has been a true activist and advocate for her communities her whole life. She said in response to Roe v. Wade being overturned, "One thing's for certain. Generations before us have faced critical moments like these and they kept fighting, just like we'll keep fighting." And she said to me personally when I was interviewing her as a bit of advice that women have to stick together in this world, show up for each other and help each other where we can, because not all women have the same privileges. Judy Chu, a U.S. congresswoman, recently in June, a year after Roe was overturned, filed a discharge petition along with some of her colleagues to force the House of Reps, which is currently Republican-led, to vote on the Women's Health Protection Act, which is an act intended to protect any person with the ability to become pregnant and establish a statutory right for all medical professionals to provide abortions for any patient requesting one. She once tweeted, "Banning abortion doesn't stop abortions. It just puts women in danger. We should be focused on expanding access to contraception, maternity care, and affordable health care. But Republicans rejected that too, because it's not about life. It's about controlling our bodies." When we think and talk about healthcare and abortion rights, it's really important to understand the intersectionality of these issues. I think mainstream feminism in the past has done a really poor job of representing all people who are affected by anti-abortion legislation. There's this book written by Mickey Kendall called Hood Feminism that was actually gifted to me by my friend Mac, who you'll hear in this podcast. The entire book is a critique on the mainstream feminist movement, which has historically been only representative of white, cis, middle-class women. One of the final chapters focuses on reproductive justice and people who are often left out of the conversation by advocates. On page 222, Kendall writes, "Reproductive justice rightfully focuses on preserving the right to choose, but too often advocates center on access to contraception at the expense of communities that are still facing other obstacles. True reproductive justice involves not only access to affordable birth control, abortion, and healthcare, but also providing access to those who are imprisoned, those who are in immigration detention centers, those who are seen as unworthy of controlling their own lives for a variety of reasons." And that's before we get into the ways that trans, non-binary, and intersex people are impacted by a framework that largely prioritizes the needs of cis, white, middle-class women. Sometimes fighting for your rights can feel like an individual task. We can feel alone and burdened by this. But it's important to remember that even though it may not seem like it, there are still people within the government system who are fighting for our rights. Power in Place is all about highlighting women in our history and in our present day who are fighting for us, but we're also all about looking towards the future and highlighting young people who are really going to change our world in the future and do great work. So I would like to focus now on my good friend Mackenzie, or Mac. She's such a great advocate for the people that she loves and her community, and I think she's just gonna change the world. So yeah, let's hear from Mac.
Okay, just a disclaimer, and I don't know if I'm gonna put this in, but we did record an entire 20 minutes of dialogue, and it was really great, and then it all got deleted. So we're feeling a little deflated, but stick with us. So I have a very special guest joining me for the latter part of this podcast, and her name is Mackenzie. She is a friend that I have had for a long time, and I really admire her and think she is just doing great things for the world. So do you want to introduce yourself, Mackenzie?
Yeah, so my name is Mackenzie. You go by Mac. You can call me whichever. And I'm a rising senior at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. I am studying women, gender, and sexuality studies with a minor in human rights. And I will also be starting an accelerated master's program this fall in global inclusion and social development.
Yeah, so you can see that she is incredibly, incredibly intelligent and just does so many things, all the things possible that one could do, and is just really amazing. And I look up to her a lot as a friend and just as a woman. Yeah, so Mackenzie, this podcast is all about, or Mac, sorry, is all about,
okay.
I don't know why I'm calling you Mackenzie, it's so formal. But this podcast is all about just highlighting, and Power in Place in general is about highlighting women who have just accomplished a lot of great things in this world and also just given back to their community in a way that's been very impactful and maybe has like broken, what do they say, broken the glass ceiling a little bit. So I'm going to ask you some more personal questions in relation to just your life and the things that you've done. So what does it mean to you to have complete ownership over your body, or what does it look like?
Yeah, I think my immediate reaction is that that looks like safety and empowerment. And to me, I think those things are kind of at opposite ends of the spectrum. I think safety comes first, and I think that looks like a lot of different things. I think that looks like having a healthcare system that listens to every individual and, you know, specifically people of color, women. We're kind of gaslit in the healthcare system, especially in regards to our menstrual cycles. You know, 1 in 10 women is diagnosed with endometriosis, but most people don't get diagnosed for at least 5 years. And so I think safety looks like being listened to about our own bodies and the understanding that we know ourselves best. I think safety also looks like, in kind of a different light of things, being able to like walk down the street and not be harassed, not be sexualized and objectified, just being able to exist as a woman in this world and not have that be a problem. And then, you know, once those things can be accomplished, or I guess not once those things are accomplished, because we can't really wait for that, but I think also empowerment. I think that, you know, being able to claim ownership of my own body and understanding that everyone else sees my own autonomy gives me more confidence to walk through the world and, you know, make decisions that work for myself.
Yeah, I love that. Great answer. Thank you. Okay, so next question. You're a very politically active person, I would say. So can you recall the first political act you did in like respect to women's rights in general, women's reproductive rights?
Yeah, so actually in my junior year of high school, I had been seeing kind of articles and testimonies left and right of women coming out about their sexual harassment or sexual assault stories. And it honestly made me feel really vulnerable and really sad, but also really angry. And I think that's kind of what ignited my passion above anything else for women's rights, because I needed to do something about it, and I knew that there were limited ways that I could control that. Mm-hmm. But I went to our vice principal and I kind of expressed to him what I was feeling and the fact that I was just disappointed in what I was seeing, but also in the fact that in part, only in part, it was a poor reflection of our education systems. You know, not having comprehensive sex ed, talking about healthy relationships, talking about consent, mm-hmm. and also just kind of the culture that thrives in high school environments and starts at such a young age. And so I was working on a program with him where we could gather a group of students and talk about the issues that were hitting home to us, and that extended beyond just, you know, what it looks like to exist as a woman in this world, but also what it looks like to exist as a person of color or a queer person. Mm-hmm. And after we would have those discussions, we'd also go into the middle school and start talking to them in kind of a palatable and digestible way so that we could get those conversations started, hopefully before, you know, it really becomes a problem.
Right. Yeah, I remember when we went to the same high school, but I remember when you did the whole project, and I think I was in those.
You were,
yeah. It was just, yeah, the whole thing. I was in a lot of amazement of your ability to just like stand up in that way and show up for, you know, the marginalized groups in our school and just really make your voice heard. And it was very impressive to me at the time, and it still is, because we were so young and you did so much. The overturning of Roe v. Wade was more about, had nothing really to do with, you know, the birth of a child or protecting children or anything like that. It really just had to deal with the government wanting to have control over women's bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you describe a time when you were reminded that your body is a political chess piece in this world, in this country?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I kind of have to answer that question in bits and pieces, because I think that kind of realization comes first in understanding that other people solely view you as a body. And so, you know, that happened when I was a little girl, when I was really young, when it was, you know, made apparent to me that people overlooked me because I was a girl. They didn't think I was as strong.
Mm-hmm.
I was meant to sit there and look pretty. Mm-hmm. I wasn't supposed to be as talkative as I was. Mm-hmm. I wasn't supposed to be all these things. And so the first part of answering that question is really just having a level of awareness about what other people expect your existence to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so that eventually translated into being sexualized as a young woman, still trying to like come into her body,
mm-hmm.
and figure out who she is. And I think a lot of women can relate to that. And then, you know, when Donald Trump became president and there was so much dismissal of his harassment and his assault and his abuse towards women, I think that's when I started to really understand my body in relation to politics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I saw other women who supported Trump, you know, kind of demoralizing the women who had spoke up against him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's how some women are used as political chess pieces. And I think that with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, it's really, really designed to be an attack on women and women of color in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, we know that white women are more likely to be financially stable, more likely to have access to resources. So if they need to get an abortion, they'll find a way. Whereas women of color are going to be subjected to a lack of access and, you know, maybe poor, more unhealthy conditions, which could be more fatal. Mm-hmm. So utilizing women's bodies as an agenda for white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And I say women's bodies specifically because I don't think that the government, as it stands right now, recognizes non-binary and trans folks. So it's targeting mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. they view mm-hmm. as women.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Okay. Next question. Is there a woman figure in your life who you find particularly inspiring?
Mm-hmm. So I have a professor at University of Massachusetts, Boston, and I only met her last fall, but since then, she's just been an incredible figure in my life. I asked her to be my mentor, so she is my mentor now. But the way she carries herself, you can really see kind of the embodiment of feminism in everything that she does. In the way that she teaches, she does teach in the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies department. So that's kind of the nature of what she teaches, but it's also in the way that she holds herself, the way that she interacts with people outside of the classroom. Mm-hmm. There's just so much care and empathy and love. And, you know, she really helped me realize that I can be kind, I can be caring, I can be empathetic, I can be all the nice little things that a woman is, quote-unquote, supposed to be, but I can also be everything else that I want to be. Mm-hmm. I can be a badass, I can not take shit, I can, you know, I'm allowed to have feelings of anger, I'm allowed to deserve what I want as well, and, you know, that's been a barrier for me a lot, is just kind of trying to find the balance of, like, you know, I want to be this loud activist, I want to be shouting from the rooftops, but I also need to know how to balance that with what's actually gonna work. But yeah, she just, I think there's been a lot of times where I get in my own way and I'm just so absorbed by overthinking before I make any decisions, and she just, you know, kind of reassures me that I'm capable, I'm intelligent, but she pushes me in ways that, you know, I maybe didn't think I was capable of before. She holds me to my shit. She keeps me accountable, and I just really look up to her because she carries herself with so much empathy, but and also an understanding of how to get things done, because she's also, you know, she's a researcher, she's done speeches, she's very involved in reproductive justice, the fight for that. So she knows what she's doing.
She knows what's up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And I've never met her, but she sounds like she's amazing. And I feel like a lot of the qualities you described are like also describing like what a good advocate is as well. Mm-hmm. Like someone who like lifts their community up, you know, also holds them to their shit, but also is like gonna represent them in a very true and honest way. And I mm-hmm. feel like you're like, it sounds like that is what she does for you on like a very individual level, which is really nice.
Absolutely.
So yeah, okay, those are all my questions. But so we'll go back to like the, we'll go back to the exercise that we were doing before. So Mac, and also our listeners, if you are able to, and it is safe for you to do so, I would love for you to participate in a little exercise for me. So I'll be asking you to close your eyes and just take some deep breaths and imagine that there is an insurmountable hill in front of you. From where you're standing right now, it may seem impossible to climb. You might feel very small next to it. You might not even be able to see the peak of it. And so imagine you're standing in front of this hill. And imagine that that hill is our fight to regain reproductive freedom in this country. And then imagine that you're on the other side of that hill. Don't worry about how you got over it quite yet. Just imagine that you're on the other side. What would you say to your former self who was looking at that hill and it looked impossible?
I think what I would say to myself is that just because it's difficult doesn't mean it's not worth trying. And you have to push yourself. That's always going to be what you have to do in order to achieve any goal that's worth it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to acknowledge how you got over the hill, because I think that it's really difficult to achieve something like that on your own. You need a support system. Even if you're kind of the first one there, you're the first one to do something, it can feel really scary, but having people who believe in you and are gonna be there with you, holding your hand, that's how you overcome those kinds of obstacles.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, and I think my answer to that would be, you know, you've done it before, and we've done it before in history in relation to gaining reproductive rights in this country. Even though Roe v. Wade was reversed and the situation that we're in now is different, and it may seem impossible that we could ever get back to that place, but it has been done. And like any challenge, you know, it has been faced. It makes me feel two ways when I look back on all, you know, these inspiring women who have fought for reproductive rights in this country before. It makes me feel sad that this fight has been going on for so long, but mm-hmm. it also makes me feel a lot less lonely in it,
mm-hmm.
And a lot more hopeful that our generation, you know, is filled with so many people who want our country to progress. So it makes me feel a lot less lonely in yeah. this fight. I don't know about you. So I'm looking at a specific statistic that says 75% of abortion patients are poor or low income. And I think that's really interesting when we think about the fight for reproductive freedom in this country. Like, that statistic in relation to, like, who actually has access to get to polls and get to voting and to be politically active. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to say a few things about that.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And in going to seminars and lectures and whatnot about how to get people, specifically young people, engaged, you know, there's been discussion about the fact that it's really inaccessible to a lot of people. And inaccessibility can look like language barriers. It can look like, you know, the language on the ballot itself is not really digestible for the average American. Even if you do have a standard education, you don't always understand what you're looking at. You know, understanding what the questions are asking, understanding everything that these candidates represent, that's not information that's made easily available. But then there are also more tangible obstacles like transportation to ballots and, you know, who is legally able to vote without kind of an equitable approach to voting. We're not genuinely going to get, you know, a result that represents everybody in this country fairly, which is exactly what democracy was designed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that applies to, you know, people who need it most, typically.
Yeah. Great response.
I think that it's kind of a scary America that we're living in right now. It feels like we're doing a lot of regressing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that the goals that we're trying to achieve can feel really, really intangible when we assess the kind of system that we're in we're in a two-party system that limits our, that's another thing, you know, about mm-hmm. voting. A lot of people avoid voting because they don't like either candidate.
Right.
And so it's like, how are we getting to a place where in a system that's supposed to represent everyone, nobody likes what their options are?
Right.
And so that in itself is just kind of screwing us over. But then also the way that the entire system was designed isn't designed for anyone but white men,
mm-hmm.
straight white men.
Yeah.
So it's difficult because it doesn't really feel like anyone with power is looking out for our best interests.
Yeah.
But I think we're seeing an overall change in culture
mm-hmm.
with, you know, our generation and younger. I think that there's a shift in the way we engage with each other daily. You know, workplaces are making different shifts to accommodate parental leave more, you know, work-life balance. And it might not seem like these things are all related, but I think that it's really important because we're recognizing the humanity in one another and that everyone's life, everyone's struggles are different. And so I think that in itself, once we're able to start showing more compassion and more empathy to one another, that's kind of the first stepping stone in making bigger changes in different ways. And, you know, we need to be listening to grassroots organizations, people from their own communities who are talking about this stuff. I think that's how we really make any progress.
Yeah. And then also that, you know, I think that culture shift, like you're saying, creates a pressure as well to, like, really show up for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you are pro-abortion, like, showing up for the people in this country who don't have the ability to vote on their behalf for
mm-hmm.
their healthcare need that they really need to have. And I think, like, when we talk about reproductive rights, like, it is interconnected with all these different things. Like, it is interconnected with the income gap in this country, the huge one. And, you know, it is connected with healthcare. It is connected with LGBTQ plus rights. Like, it is connected with all these different things. Anything else?
I don't know.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being here. I loved having you.
I love talking to you about this stuff.
Great. We're in it together. We're all in it together. The final note I'll leave you on is do what you can, do what you're able to, but always push yourself to do better and show up for the people in this world who lack the resources to fight for their own rights. Even if you live in a blue state, it's important to understand there still may be restrictions when it comes to abortion care. For example, Massachusetts is the only state in New England that has a 24-hour waiting period after a woman gives consent for an abortion. We won't have true reproductive freedom in this country until every person that needs access to a safe and affordable abortion has it. Make sure to follow Power in Place on Spotify, look us up online, and follow our Instagram @PowerInPlace. Thanks so much for listening, guys. Have a good summer.